Hello, listeners. Right, let's have a quick quiz. If you live in one of the biggest cities in England, how long should it take to get internet connected? Anybody? What's that? A day? Who said that? What crazy loon said that? Mike, what do you reckon?
Oh, we live in the future now, in a modern... Well, I live in a completely different country, but... I'd have to say, like, I don't know, 72 hours maximum.
Oh, well, never mind. Maybe one day. Maybe in Germany, where things work and the trains arrive on time. But we've yet to have that technological awesomeness in Britain, so it's going to take Ben 2 weeks to get the internet.
2 weeks?
Yeah.
2 weeks in his new place.
It's appalling, isn't it? In Bristol...
In a large city.
Yeah.
That's not... Oh, that's...
Yeah, Ben has moved house, everyone.
Hmm. So he occasionally drops us a fleeting line from random internet cafes in the Bristol area, but that's about the best he can do.
Wearing his polo neck, smoking gitanes. Whatever else it is that people in Bristol do, I don't know. Too cool for me. So that's why it's just us three. I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Graham Morrison.
And I'm Mike Saunders.
And sadly, without Ben this fortnight, it's time for Season 2, Episode 16 of the Linux Voice Podcast.
Woo-hoo. That was the second take, dear listener.
One day. So, we've got news to come.
Mm.
We have our finds of the fortnight. There may or may not be a halfway reminder, which I know from all the volume of letters we get is often people's favourite section.
It's short and to the point.
It may actually be halfway this time because we don't have Ben doing the news.
Oh, cool. there's a neuron to vocalise, and there's quite possibly a voice of the masses.
We should mention, for the Ben fans who are about to turn off, thinking Ben isn't in this, he has promised to record some of the neurons and send them to us, so hopefully we'll hear his lovely voice in a few minutes.
That's true, you're right, Mike, yeah. Maybe I could put a silly robot effect on it.
We know that's popular.
So if you like the sound of that, but more professionally done, and in paper format, or even in EPUB format, you can subscribe to Linux Voice at shop.linuxvoice.com, and that's 114 pages of just all sorts of information about stuff. Linux mainly.
Primarily, yeah. So without further ado, let's look at the news for this month. I've got a new email, but that's not really news, is it? First off, the NHS has ditched Oracle from its background that stores all these patient information and sends these messages around. And with their new Spine 2 backbone, they've got rid of Oracle and they've moved to an open source NoSQL stack. This is all running on a huge number of Linux machines. That's a big change, isn't it?
Yeah, it's huge. And for people who may not be aware, the NHS is our socialist healthcare system over here in the UK, responsible for one of the biggest IT project failures of all time. but I mean, yes, it's tempting to say somebody may know what they're doing at the NHS now. There's been talk as well that Oracle has broken its terms of its contract, or that the NHS is going to have to pay compensation to Oracle, but. It sounds like the perfect use for a NoSQL solution, considering the size of the data set.
Well, we often, when we look at the evil versus non-evil stuff that Google does, attempt to explain it by saying that there are that many people within Google that some of them will have their head screwed on and some of them won't.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas the NHS as an organisation must be about a bajillion times the size of Google.
Yes, you're right. I mean, yes, it's a significant employer, isn't it, in the UK?
It's huge, the
biggest?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I mean, I was reading one report and it says that this Spine 2 system has information on 80 million people in Britain. And given that there are only 64 million people in Britain, that's a bit odd. But apparently it includes records from people who've died as well, because that can be useful in, you know, future diagnostics.
If they've been cryogenically frozen. Did they say why they chose to... What was the problem with Oracle, or why they chose a different solution?
I mean, this is they've been moving over for a year or so. One of the big things was apparently to save money as well, helping the British government cut the amount of money it spends on IT, and that's been, you know, one of the goals of the current administration. So, Oracle and Larry Ellison always love to jump around and claim that they're a solution to everything big data, but. Yeah, and there are a lot of people who are still dubious about NoSQL. You know, which NoSQL fans say it doesn't just mean NoSQL now, but it also means not only SQL. So it means there are more options. But yeah, that's a big news.
There is an NHS open source hack day taking place in Leeds in a couple of weekends' time. I think that's on the 27th, Saturday the 27th.
Well, hack the NHS. That'd be a good magazine title, wouldn't it?
Well, if you're interested in that sort of thing, you know, open source technologies and open formats and how to apply that to an enormous, huge state-owned sector, then, you know, maybe toddle along and find out what's what.
In Leeds, you say?
That one.
Meanwhile, it looks like GNOME, with the upcoming version 3.14, is going to integrate with Systemd even more tightly. So GNOME 3, one of the most controversial projects, and Systemd, one of the most controversial projects, getting ever better buddies. Now, part of the reason for this is the GNOME guys say they want to stop dealing with all the session management and login stuff themselves, and that's something Systemd can do. And I can kind of understand that, because if Systemd does that and then all the desktops use Systemd, then that's reducing duplication if all the desktops don't have to do that themselves. But of course, yeah, some people will hate it. And there's a great entry on the GNOME blog explaining why they've chosen to do this, with a big section trying to dispel loads of myths. And we're going to talk about Systemd later in the Voice of the Masses, but... It looks like there's not really much stopping it, is there?
No, and sometimes, even if it's not the best technical solution, I think it can be better that we just all start using one solution. You know, if Debian's going to use Systemd, I think that's a good enough reason for GNOME to start using Systemd, that kind of thing. You know, especially if it replaces the redundancy of all of these desktops doing different login managers or using different mechanisms for login and init, which is a very important part, used to be an important part.
I think so, yeah. I mean, a lot of people, and again, this is what we'll talk about more later, but a lot of people complain about the potential monoculture that is forming around Systemd. But I think for a lot of the plumbing stuff underneath, you know, that doesn't really concern me. It doesn't bother me that we've just got one kernel with various patch sets. I think that's better than having 50 slightly different, slightly incompatible kernels. It's great to have a choice of desktops and distros and window managers. But for a lot of the basic stuff, you know, you just want a core tool set. But...
Yeah, I mean, we basically got one kernel, and Systemd is a part of that, really.
Well, yeah, it's becoming the part of the base system. Linux has never had a base system, so to speak, has it? Unlike, say, the BSDs, where the kernel and the core libraries and stuff are developed in sync. How is what's the situation with KDE and Systemd, Graham?
I don't know.
I presume they're going to get more integrated as well.
It would be nice if it worked in the same way, yeah. If GNOME's doing it, it'd be nice, because it's always frustrating. Anyway, working with multiple desktops, which I often do, trying to work around these things anyway, so...
Mm. Next up, Mega, the file sharing platform created by the very famous Kim.com. Kim.com got into various legal wranglings, didn't he? And then I don't really know the full story.
All out war,
it.
I think. so he was the guy that created Mega Uploads. Is that what it's called? Which,
yeah.
If you ever Googled for a movie title about 3 or 4 years ago, you'd always find a Mega Uploads link in there for, you know, 10 or 20 files of the movie split into various parts and anonymously hosted on Mega Uploads.
Aha.
Which I think over the time has this is what's got him in trouble. He's probably using the, you know, it's the nature of the internet, and this is the clash of the big media corporations with the openness of the internet, and this is one of the places where the tectonic plates are causing, you know, eruptions. Because of this, and because I guess he wants to distance himself even further from the data that people host on his sites or hosted on his sites, he's built a system that he claims is incredibly strong encryption, uses incredibly and strong encryption, so that no one, the feds, man, can read your data.
So does that sort of separate him from any potential copyright claims and stuff? Because he says all we're storing is a bunch of basically random data that we can't read.
Yeah, I think, but also his I think he's capitalizing on everybody else basically allowing backdoors into their systems by saying, you know, he's not going to allow that to happen. Of course, this is all closed source, so we've no way of trusting it.
Yeah, well, the reason that this is in the news here is that now they have Mega has offered the MegaSync synchronization client for Linux. So it's supported on all the major distributions on x86 and 64-bit as well. And they say that they plan to release the source code to this MegaSync under an open source license at some point.
Well, that's good. It's the same with BitTorrent Sync. That's not been released under an open source license yet, you can run your own BitTorrent Sync server, but you don't really have any knowledge of whether it's communicating with any other servers or whether there's a backdoor. And I guess it's going to be the same with this. But if it's in a way, it's an alternative to Dropbox more than anything else. And if you don't like the idea of Condoleezza Rice being on the board of directors, then it's an alternative.
Well, also, as I understand it, I don't use any of these cloud storage systems at all. But Dropbox, I think, gives you 2 gigabytes for free, whereas Mega seems to give you 50 gigabytes.
Yeah, and Dropbox, I think, has just revised its pricing. So I think 1 terabyte of storage is not very much money.
Right, okay.
Do you not use Google Drive, Mike?
Actually, you're right. I do use that for some very small bits and bobs. Yeah,
but... celebrity photographs.
The first time I ever used MegaSync, Mega was actually yesterday, which is leads into our next news story that apparently there are 5 million. Compromised Google accounts or Google Mail accounts, and the information about these accounts is circulating on the web. Now, Mega, somebody put up on Mega a list of the supposedly hacked accounts without passwords, but so you could go and check to see if your own email address had been hacksawed. So I downloaded it and opened it in Vim. And it's just more testimony to how awesome Vim is, because it was, I can't remember if it was like 500 megabyte text file or something bonkers like that. But Vim just zoomed around like it was, you know, just your shopping list. So, I'm not on it. Have you guys checked whether you're on it?
I did check. Somebody on our IRC channel said they checked and did find their email address, because otherwise I'm kind of cynical about whether they're genuine lists of addresses, but it appears that it is.
Liam found his as well, Liam Dorr.
Did he?
Our end of level games boss. But apparently it wasn't compromised.
It's incredibly worrying.
How does he know it hadn't been compromised?
I don't know. It was in a Twitter thing that I read several hours ago. So the information has flown back out of my brain now.
Gmail is quite good for giving you... Well, firstly, you can enable two-factor authentication, which is really important. Secondly, you can check from wherever the IP address of wherever your email account has been accessed, and that includes both like IMAP Gmail access as well as through the web interface.
Yeah.
So, unless somebody really has cleverly hacked the system, you can check to see whether it's been compromised.
Yeah, they're thinking now it's not. There's not a problem in Google Mail per se, because that would be absolutely enormous.
But where do 5 million email addresses come from and passwords?
Well, how many users of Google Mail are there? There might be 500 million, and you know, you only have to set up a few scams and honeypots, social engineering and stuff. It is a large number, isn't it?
But, yeah, it sounds like there's a weakness somewhere.
Could be. Maybe the NSA leaked it for reason. So, the NSA will have all this information anyway. So, yeah. Moving on, what else have we got? The Free Software Foundation and Debian have joined forces to help work together on a website that I think was one of my finds of the fortnight.
Yes. Yeah,
This is Hnode, h-node.org, which is a collection. It's a repository of information about hardware that works with purely free software. So laptops, PCs, graphics cards, network cards and stuff that works without requiring awkward binary blobs and stuff like that. It should all work on things like Trisquel, GNU Linux. And I think this is good. People don't tend to pay that much attention to purely free software supported hardware, but we don't want to end up going down a slippery slope. It's good to make note of these things.
Yeah, it is. I think we don't often think about free hardware. You know, we were talking about last time how difficult it is to just even get a laptop where you can run free firmware and a free BIOS and everything. It's almost impossible to a practical extent. So anything that highlights that difficulty and also gives people who do provide completely open source firmware and drivers, you know, a bit of credit, especially when it's attached to Debian, which is much more feasible, and the FSF kind of accepting that there's more to life than the herd, you know, it's good.
Well, that's interesting, yeah, because Debian GNU/Linux is not actually on the Free Software Foundation's list of recommended.
It's not.
Distributions, no, because it provides access to non-free software. I think it's a bit sort of over the top. You know, so if you look on their lists, it's either on GNU.org or FSF.org, but you'll see Trisquel and I think like Dynabolic and a few other smaller name distros, but they won't recognize Debian as being a truly. So, and yet Debian is by far and a long way the biggest of all those distros. I mean, Trisquel is based on Ubuntu and Debian anyway, isn't it?
But Debian, do they still use IceWeasel instead of Firefox, don't they?
Yeah, a lot of that is to do with like trademarks isn't it?
But that is, I mean, it shows that they are on the ball and they have the ethics committee and the freedom policy, and you're not going to go far wrong with Debian. I think it says more about the Free Software Foundation than it does about Debian that they refuse to endorse it.
I think you're absolutely right. Yeah, the Debian makes it very clear what is free and what is non-free. It's just the fact that it even gives you the option to install non-free software.
That's, gives you the freedom.
It gives you the freedom to
be non-free. There's something Rousseau said. Oh, I don't know. I can't remember now. Again, that was more than a few hours ago.
Did Rousseau say anything about doubly recursive acronyms as well?
Oh, Mike, the day was going so well.
let's not get Andrew started on that.
Such a happy mood.
But the participation of a huge, big-name distro like Debian in this will hopefully really help the project. And then what else have we got? I think we're coming to the end of our news stories. Oh, and then there's a chance. There's a rumor going around that Microsoft is close to purchasing. Is it Mojang or Mohang, or how do you pronounce it? Anybody know?
I don't know. Is it Mojang?
I guess Mojang.
Presumably Mojang. Mojang, of course, is the company behind Minecraft. It wasn't that long ago when Facebook bought the Oculus Rift. That or Oculus VR, whatever the company is, that Notch, Minecraft's creator, was pretty miffed about the whole thing, wasn't he?
I think the interesting thing about this story is that Minecraft has pretty much become an ecosystem for teenagers everywhere. You know, it provides all kinds of level of virtual Lego goodness for everybody who wants to be creative with their Linux machines and their Windows machines and their tablets and their consoles. And $2 billion is the rumored price that Microsoft's willing to pay, which is just one of those incredible numbers that we could sample and use at the end of the Christmas special. But I mean, forgetting the incredible amount, which is too much to pay for anything, it's a pretty shrewd move by Microsoft, Because whereas you can argue, if it's true, of course, this might not be true, but you could argue that unlike kind of some of the one-hit wonders that come up with things like Farmville, you know, I actually think Minecraft and its future is probably quite a positive one, considering that Minecraft itself is a very retro-looking game. The its addictiveness is in the nature of the gameplay, yeah. And that gameplay is kind of timeless. I can see it going on in 5 or 10 years or 15 years.
It's not going to look dated 10 years down the line, is it?
No. And, you know, you can see the potential for Microsoft owning that and then making it available only for Windows and Xbox consoles, for example, which is perhaps why this story is interesting, because that's going to be really sad for us and for teenagers and kids in general.
Or the free version is plastered with adverts. Like if the sky, instead of the sun, you looked up and there was just a smiling baby or something that occasionally said calm, soothing things like buy Snickers.
or instead stuff, of a pickaxe, like you have a Snickers bar.
Yeah. Do you have to eat food to replenish yourself in Microsoft, in Minecraft?
Yes, and in Microsoft, yeah.
Right, well, there you go then. There's all sorts of brilliant commercial opportunities there.
Come to think of it, yeah, currently Minecraft involves you going around punching cows to extract meat from them. So, yeah, it could probably be made a bit more realistic by having you make pot noodles or something. You've got to find some water down by the beach and create a fire to boil it and then... But, yeah, if Microsoft does buy it and locks it all down, closes it, makes it only available for Windows, fortunately, we have a pretty good replacement in the pipeline, a free software open source replacement, Minetest. I revisit it periodically. It's still way behind Minecraft in terms of richness and features and depth, but it's at version, I don't know, 0.5 or something. So, that could really spur on its development. And yeah, who knows? In 10 years' time, Minecraft might be some thing everybody's forgotten about, and everybody could be playing Minetest.
Yeah, yeah.
And I believe that is the end of the news section.
Wow, lightning news.
That was excellent, and just as long as Ben. All those times I've blamed Ben for the news going so long. And it's us, it's all of us. So, finds of the fortnight.
Yeah.
Of the 3 weeks. And I'm really sorry it's been 3 weeks. It's been mostly my fault. I've been travelling around and then Ben's had trouble with internet. But I have got some finds. But shall I go first?
Yeah, why not?
Well, I think it was the last time I said I'd discovered a game called Fez. Now, I'd not heard about Fez at the time, but having since played it and completed it, it was a huge game on its first release, like 2012. When you complete it, you've done it 100%, but I've carried on playing it, and I've got to about 206% in my completion percentage, and it's the game just gets better and better and better. It's brilliant. My discovery is that there won't be a sequel, unfortunately. The guy that created it has been involved in, I don't know, there's this insane kind of gamer thing going on about... I really don't want to get into it, but it's resulted in a lot of negativity and a lot of bad publicity and a lot of awful things being said to people, including Phil Fish, the creator of Fez, which ended up with him being docked and everything. So they managed to get all of the kind of development files, the accounts, the finances, his personal banking information, all of this stuff was put up on the internet.
He was doxxed then.
Yeah, doxxed, yeah. And he quite rightly said, you know something, I've had enough of all of this. You know, I tried to create this awesome stuff and, you know, and he's now just going to sell all the IP behind Fez and his company to the highest bidder, and he just wants out. He doesn't want anything to do with the gaming community.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a shame.
Kind of a negative thing. It is a shame, and I don't really know where all this hate comes from. I really would like to see who these people really are, because I suspect they're just 12-year-olds sat in their bedroom.
Well, there's this one person called 4chan, according to CNN.
Who is 4chan?
I think it's this 4chan guy. He's like causing so much lulls and aggro on the internet.
Now, my other discovery I can kind of talk about now, because I came out as admitting that I'd got a Mac a couple of episodes ago.
It's okay. Your parents will understand you.
And that I'd been getting Linux and KDE running really well on it. My next challenge has been getting the touchpad, the magic pad or whatever Apple calls it, working in Linux.
The genius pad. The awesome pad.
It's amazing. But it doesn't work very well in Linux. I mean, the great thing about Apple is they've probably got 1,000 people working on calibrating the input from the touchpad. The good thing is that the Synaptic driver in Linux works well. The problem is that you can recognize up to 10 finger input, and it can be triggered falsely by touching your palm and all that kind of stuff. The default options with the latest Synaptic driver work well. There are good control panels in both GNOME and KDE for getting rid of false palm prints and setting touch thresholds and stuff like that. But what I was mostly interested in is the multi-touch gestures. And Linux there's no standard for multi-touch gestures in Linux. It's still bad. I've mentioned it before, and it hasn't got any better. And despite the fact that all the data is there, when you actually look at the data coming out of the touchpad, it just needs someone to go through the data and create a standard. And while there isn't a standard, there's a Perl script called XSwipe. And XSwipe interprets all the data coming out of the Synaptics driver and allows you to set swipe gestures as keyboard shortcuts. So you can do 3 or 4 or 5 finger swipes up, down, left and right, or from the border of the touchpad, and assign them to simple keyboard shortcuts. So
that's great.
Yeah. If you do, like, for example, I've got Alt and cursor keys to switch between virtual desktops. So if I just assign the gestures to those shortcuts, I can switch between virtual desktops just by swiping 4 fingers across the touchpad. Or you can do the same as expose mode, you know, and 4 fingers swipe up and stuff like that. What I haven't found, and I must admit I like this in OS X, is that if you touch 3 fingers, it's the same as left clicking and holding the left button down. So you can just move 3 fingers to the top of a Windows title bar and move a window around without pressing anything. So I've yet to find that. But because XSwipe is a Perl script, it should be relatively hackable, and I might be able to get something like that working myself. And they're my discoveries.
That's genuinely useful, actually. Ooh. Yeah. You want to have a go, Andrew?
Yeah, I'll have a go. 2 discoveries. Discovery number 1, CorelDRAW. One of my contacts at the Yorkshire Wildlife Trust was trying to open up some CorelDRAW files from 1999, which they'd paid for, but they paid some design agency to do, and it only opens in, what was it, CorelDRAW version 4. So they were all, oh no, does this mean that we're going to have to spend 2 days redrawing everything? Because, you know, we don't have this software, and it's commercial software. And, oh dear, closed source lock-in strikes. Because we say this all the time, but it always, today, it feels like such an abstract threat that one day, you just wait, one day in 15 years, you won't be able to open that file. You think, yeah, so what, Grandad? I'll have saved it. I'll have saved it in so many different formats since then, or between now and 15 years in the future, that it's just never going to happen. Well, this was happening now, or 2 days ago. And it just brought home to me, you know, again, for the millionth time, how important open files are. But also, I could open it. I could more or less open them up in LibreOffice.
I know that over the years, they've put a lot of effort into filters for relatively old or obscure file formats, because they were doing stuff with old WordPerfect files, which I think was also Corel, wasn't it? But yeah, I think this is another area where open source programs just tend to completely kick ass. It's like VLC an M player will just throw anything you play, anything you throw it, including I've got these old like real media, real video files. Wow. from VHS. I ripped VHS cassettes in like the early 2000s to store them on my computer through a Halpage TV card and stuff. And so they still exist in this terrible old real video format. But you know, VLC plays it and doesn't care one jot. I bet it doesn't work out the box in Windows.
No, you're right. I remember those RTSP files.
Good work, Andrew. Good work, both of you, with your discoveries, but I've got some finds. it's too late now. It's too late. I found out I've got three things. The first one is that it's illegal to own a single guinea pig in Switzerland.
Even if you're testing on them.
It is. Due to the animal's social nature, you can't own single ones. And so if one of your guinea pigs dies, somebody set up a service so you can rent guinea pigs for a few weeks or months. Oh, you have to kill the other one, yeah.
Or stuff the dead one.
for when the guinea pig police come round. Yeah.
A little Arduino in there to get it to wobble its head.
Do you reckon we can get Ben to do something for the magazine? Yeah. For our Swiss readers, revive your dead guinea pig with a Model B. The second thing I found is something I've not used and I will probably never ever use. So why am I? And it's for Windows. So why am I suggesting it? Well, it's called Chocolaty, and it's like apt-get, but for Windows. So you can easily get various programs, mostly open source, but a few proprietary things as well, with simple apt-get commands. Mm. So you get the latest versions. If you want the latest version of Chrome, apt-get install Chrome. You don't need to scoot around different websites, so go to the About box and update and stuff like that. And then if you want, you know, there's no sensible package management system built into Windows because it's a completely rubbish operating system. But if you just want to get some free software with a single command, then you type Chocolaty install blah blah whatever. The syntax looks pretty similar. I just thought I'd mention it to any poor listeners out there battling on in Windows for whatever reason who wish they had all the Debian Yum style goodness. And the final find of my fortnight is, or 3 weeks, is Doom RL. Now, everybody on the planet has heard of Doom and probably played Doom. Doom RL is Doom roguelike. So it's Doom, but in the like NetHack rogue
top-down
ASCII fashion, turn-based fashion. I haven't actually played it yet because I only discovered it a few hours ago. But if I can get it to compile, I'm going to put it in FOSPIX in... We're just working on Linux Voice issue 9 now, so if I can get it to compile, it will be in the FOSPIX section of that very magazine.
I know. Soon. Where's the time gone?
I don't know.
Right, and it's over to Ben. Let's see if we can tune into his spooky finds of the fortnight.
Got a few finds this fortnight. I'll start with the least technical and move on to the more Linux-related ones. Firstly, I've moved a house a couple of days ago. Moved down from Gloucester to Bristol. And I just picked up the keys and I was making sure the house was all right and getting ready to move in the next day. And one of the neighbours was in the garden, so he just sort of poked my head over the fence, said hi, and just chatting about what was going on. And he said, "Ooh, I suppose you know about the murders." And I was like, "What? The murders?" And she was all very cagey. "Oh yes, there was a serial killer who lived there, but I'll let you find out about it by yourself." I said, Sounded a bit dubious to me. But anyway, I've done some research. And it turns out that yes, a serial killer did indeed live in my house. By some reckonings, one of the most prolific serial killers in, well, certainly in British history. She was what they call a baby farmer, which basically means, this is way back in Victorian times, in like 1880 or something. And she got out of wedlock mothers who'd just given birth to pay her to get their children adopted. Except she didn't get their children adopted, she killed them. And she was eventually caught in London after a baby's body was fished out of the Thames and it was traced back to her. And she was only ever convicted of a single murder, so none of the others who have really investigated, because she was hung for one, so there's no point in doing any more. But by some estimates, everywhere seems to say, anyway, around or up to 400 babies were killed by her. And I know that some, in the early 1900s, about 1903, I think, some bodies were dug up in our garden. So, certainly adds a bit of character to the house, a slightly grisly history. She didn't live here for long, I should point out. It wasn't her main base. She was only here for a couple of years. So it's not like a full 400 were killed here. But, yes, that's an interesting thing to find out. Oh, and she's also... A few people have claimed that she might be Jack the Ripper, but that doesn't seem to have much credibility. That's an interesting thing to find as I was moving in. The second thing, also related to that, is I was amazed by this. It takes 2 weeks to get an internet connection in Bristol. 2 weeks! So I've got to rely on the old fairly poor 3G signal until then. So no streaming videos or anything for me. And I guess kind of related to that as well. I'm surviving on mobile data. And it's one of those things that I have a certain amount of data that comes free every month. And I was just sort of scanning through how much of it I used and which applications were using it. And it turned out my email client was drawing huge amounts. And for one of my, I've got a few email addresses. This was for my personal one. And I don't actually get all that many emails on. And I actually use it very little. I don't tend to download emails and read them on there. I just use it for notifications and then occasionally go and to my computer and get them. So this had used 100 meg in a few days, despite only being used to read like 2 emails. So what's going on here? So I filtered through, it's on Android, and it's quite good. You can filter your applications by data usage and then look in. And it's got what they call foreground and background data usage. And I looked in there and turned out this was almost all background data. So for some reason, it was downloading huge amounts of my emails when the app wasn't even at the front, when I wasn't reading emails. No idea what that amount of data was. I mean, to be honest, I can't even imagine all the emails and pictures added up to 100 meg. But whatever, there we go. But when I dropped down, I've discovered on Android you can disable background data. So apps can still download things from the internet when you're using them, but when they're in the background, when they're not being used, they can't access the internet. So I've done that, and since then my data usage has dropped down to a normal level. And at first thought, actually, this is a really good feature, you know? And then it got me wondering, why is it that you can only download, you can only block background data? Why can't you block foreground data? And, this might sound a little bit tinfoil hat-ish, maybe it's wrong. But of course, Google's an advertising company, mainly. That's where they get the vast majority of their money from. And a lot of apps have embedded adverts. A lot of them, that's the only reason they access the internet for. So if you could block foreground data, that means you could just essentially disable adverts on a large proportion of apps without actually... really cause them any problems in any way. So although it is quite good that they've got this block background data thing, it does kind of highlight the problem of getting an operating system designed by an advertising company. They've obviously restricted it in ways that would disadvantage them, but would advantage you, the user. And I thought I'd compare it, because I've got a CyanogenMod tablet, and then that, actually it's quite an old version of CyanogenMod, I should update it. But that didn't even have the block background data. So I assume it's a relatively new feature of Android. Maybe we will get block foreground data in the future. Maybe I'm just being overly paranoid. But those are my finds this fortnight.
Thanks, Ben. Your new place certainly sounds a lot bigger than your old one.
So now here's Ben with a neuron. Hey, Ben.
We've got 3 neurons this month. John Spriggs says, I wanted to drop a note to you guys to let you know about Rizoma. Rizoma, perhaps? Rizoma? I don't know. Anyway, whatever it, however it's pronounced, it's a clone of the Google Wave project. The key thing for me about Rizoma is that it looks nice, almost as nice as Wave did. It's not as slow as Wave, and they don't have the Watch Me type feature that Wave had and Etherpad does, but it does have an auto update on save. When we asked him what he'd used Rizoma for, he said, I found it was really good for developing an API for a web app with my front-end developer. You can think of it as a supercharged version of the comments feature on Word's track changes tool. That does sound quite an interesting project. It's not one I've actually come across, and without internet, it's not one I'm going to be using for the next week or two at least. But it's certainly one I'll keep an eye out for. Neuron number two. Sheridan Lehman says, how about writing an article on Rizome? It's a massively multiplayer online role-playing game that was started by the French but never finished. It's an internationally played game. It has a native Linux client and it's gone open source. If you decide to try it out, I'm a triker named Urom, I think, and I'm currently spending most of my time in Fairhaven. I've no idea what a triker is or where Fairhaven is, but it does sound quite interesting. But again, for some reason, neurons this month seem to be all to do with the internet, so it's not ones I can try out. But yes, assuming you're listening to this, you probably do have the internet. So yeah, if you're looking for an online role-playing game, give it a go. And our final neuron, Mr. MJB says, I just thought you'd like to know that I've taken my son to a princess-themed horse-riding party, and there's actually a pink pony here. That does sound exciting, although, if it's a horse riding party, surely they shouldn't have ponies? Can't have ponies when you're claiming horses? Or perhaps I'm just being too picky. Anyway, those are the neurons this month. If you'd like yours to be read out in a future podcast, drop us an email with your thoughts, and we'll turn it into audio and upload it to the web.
It's time for Voice of the Masses. Our Voice of the Masses was a little bit cryptic this time, in fact, so much so that I didn't understand it. The question was, do you like systemed?
Systemed. Yeah, it wasn't a typo, Andrew, amazingly enough from me. But this is all about systemd, and it's probably the hottest topic in Linux right now, at least amongst sort of distro developers and more technical types. So, just to briefly clarify what this is about, systemd is a replacement boot system for GNU/Linux machines. So previously, to boot up a system, you had a single program called init that started a huge number of disparate scripts, often written by different people, trying to work together, trying to check if each other had started different programs, stuff like that. It was all text-based, so it was clear, it was simple to edit and read, but it could all become a bit of a mess, and it was hard to do things in parallel. Systemd came along and said, we're going to unify this, we're going to put it all into a single system, start things in parallel, make it easier for to have dependencies on between programs that are started at boot. That was fair enough. Systemd has been growing meanwhile. It's taking over things like user logins, it's taking over syslog, the system logging, it's taking over cron, and so forth. It's becoming a real base system for Linux. And some people like that and saying, well, it's good to have these sort of standards across distros. And other people are saying it goes against the Unix way. It's still a big argument going on, so that's why we asked our lovely listeners.
The Unix way being that lots of small things should do lots of small tasks.
Yeah.
And also, init was really easy to understand because it really was just a link of script that you could go in and easily edit yourself, whereas you can't do that with systemd. There's a more formalized procedure, which I don't really understand. And that's the main issue. It is difficult to understand because it's written by the same guy that wrote Pulse Audio.
well, that's the beef of a lot of people.
Well, that brings us on to Javier, who says, systemd by the same guy who made Pulse Audio. Anything else to add? and a couple of other people have pointed to that same thing. I've never had a problem with Linux Audio, so I really just can't comment.
And maybe you'd, and this is it, people aren't going to have a problem with Linux booting. Most people aren't.
You press the on switch and then it boots up. I'd say, you know, so what? we were talking about the Unix philosophy, the Unix way of doing things. Andrew Conway says, I think System D is misconceived in that it breaks from the traditions and the philosophy that underpins the power and success of Unix-like systems. The two often cited examples are that it has binary logs instead of text files, and more importantly, it tries to centralize too much, and instead there should be many small tools for specific tasks. I'm not qualified to comment on the implementation and code quality, but it's clear that too many that are experienced, such as Torvalds and Cho, Ted Cho that is, are very concerned about it. Pulse Audio is relevant, I think. I was And then some stuff about Pulse Audio. Our legal correspondent says that when we're reviewing software, we should really be looking at the software rather than who wrote it, because a fair criticism of software is fair. Well, just dissing everything that one person or one company does is it's either libel or slander. I can never remember which.
I think it's interesting when people are talking about the Unix philosophy of small tools that do one thing, because in a sense, systemd is like that. If you compile it, you get something like 60 different utilities. Now people say, oh well, they're all from the same source, but so it is in core utils. You know, those are all made together, your ls and your df and stuff like that. They are small tools that work together. The logging, binary logging, I can understand is a concern for a lot of people. I mean, apparently you can redirect everything to syslog anyway if you'd rather look at your logs through grep and usual text tools. But to me, it seems that if systemd does become a standard base system across various distributions, then that is, in a way, that is a bit more like the BSD model of development, where the kernel, the libraries, and all this stuff is developed in the same place. And nobody would argue that BSD isn't a Unix. So that's my two cents. So there we go.
Well, more comments from Enum Nom Nom, who says, hiya Mark, who says, systemd may have its detractors, including me, but the fact is that working code speaks volumes louder than any opinionated mouthy developer, including me again. And until a better pile of working code gets written, it's going to be here to stay. Yes. Matthew S. says, it feels like a bunch of Java developers have had a go at messing around with core components of the operating system. Oh no, not Java. Stephen Wheeler says, the Unix philosophy is a good philosophy, has stood us in good stead, and is one of the reasons Unix and Linux are such robust and adaptable systems. Systemd might streamline and speed things up now, but I can't help but think it's storing up a whole lot of hurt for the future. I don't really understand the question well enough to link these questions, these responses into a pattern, to be honest. So I'm just going to read out random words. I can't really motivate myself to have emotions towards it, says Paul H.
There were quite a few positive comments as well, weren't there, from people who said they'd learnt it and got used to it and were happy with it.
I think if you spend a lot of time with it, or if booting is your thing, it's probably a really good solution. I mean, bringing up Pulse Audio again, it actually works. It's brilliant. You get low latency, rock solid audio, and it's the way that it's been designed means that it's the most flexible audio subsystem you could ever hope for. But the problem with Pulse Audio, and the problem that I also have with systemd, is that my brain can't get its head around it. I have to, if I need to do anything in Pulse Audio, I have to spend ages researching it before being able to do what I need to do. And it's the same with systemd. This may be a good thing and it may be a bad thing, but I've had to have quite a lot of dealing with systemd and configuring things and adding and customizing and modifying services. And each time I end up looking up what I need to do, the syntax for doing this or that or the other, or why hasn't this specifically worked, and what should this be called? And that's coming from, you know, 10 years ago, it was always so straightforward. You could hack stuff in. It was easy to understand what was happening and where. And that has now gone. And maybe that's just a sign of the maturity of Linux, because it doesn't have to be simple. It needs to be stable. So that's the most important thing. And systemd seems to offer that. It does work. But yeah, the compromise is complexity. And whoever it was who said that, was that Andrew Conway, who wasn't qualified to say, I suppose I'm the same thing. Mm. I mean, booting, really, I have no real knowledge of, and I'm quite happy to leave it to the people who know about these things to make a decision.
There's a nice little elitist comment here. Bob says, I have no real understanding of the history of System D or why people who have don't like it. I've heard vague things about not adhering to the Unix philosophy. As a user of System D, though, I like it. It's easy to create a startup script, and I've never had any problems with it. I, of course, also never had problems with init scripts. After Arch switched to System D, I've used it, and I can't complain. And then the response to that from Ricer says, you are just a user, a consumer. So someone who's written boot scripts with Arch is not elite enough to understand the issues at hand.
But the boot scripts for System D, I found horrendously complicated.
you're so far down the food chain, you know.
But they're so lengthy. I have no idea what they're doing and what they're calling on and why they need to do all the things that they need to do.
It's because they're interacting with GNOME and cron and KAlbum and all sorts of stuff.
So is there any kind of conclusion?
I don't understand. There may be a conclusion, but I don't understand the words that are written down well enough to extrapolate a conclusion.
Some people have gone off on benders and said that, oh, this is all like Red Hat forcing this on everybody. But, you know, there may be a point to that argument in that the more distros that choose System D, the harder it is to get away from it. But I don't think, you know, distros like Arch adopted it just because they felt, oh, well, Red Hat's pushing it on us. The Arch guys are operating a completely different way to that. They've chosen to do it because they're bleeding edge. They think it's technically right. And I think that's the case with most distros. It's not just, you know, Red Hat has as much sway as people think. It's big in the enterprise. But, yeah, people are going to do things, you know, Slackware and Gentoo are showing no interest in System D. So
I think that's a really good point. Yeah, I mean, it's been the default for Arch since a very painful podcast about 18 months ago where I couldn't get my system working. We should do a tutorial on it. So we force ourselves to get our heads around it.
I plan to write such a tutorial in Linux Voice issue 10, which is obviously a while away. Awesome. I think on sale at the end of November, but yeah.
It'll take 3 months to read the man pages of 62 utilities.
Yeah, it's going to be a 48-page tutorial, by the way, as well. So, yeah, we could even make System D voice, perhaps.
Excellent. Let's make it our Christmas special.
Is that it then? Have we come to the end of the podcast?
I think that's it, and that's good because I've got to get off and do other things.
Wow. Okay. Have you got a real life, Andrew?
Yes, I have. I've got to do the washing up, which I said I'd do before Sally got in.
Well. Thanks for everyone for persevering with our continuous delay. Thanks, guys. Good to see you.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
And we'll be back in 2 weeks.
Hopefully, all being well.
Yeah.
Yes. Bye-bye.
Bye.